Just as I was concluding it, I was discussing my efforts at first efforts in federal aid education. It was federal aid to school construction. It ended up being public law, I believe, 875 and 874. These were the two acts that one of which provided aid to the physical plants, physical facilities of schools and areas of heavy federal activity. The other provided federal aid for the management or the administration of schools, that is, the services related to education. Now, this aid has, since 1950, has amounted to several billions of dollars. It was possibly the first substantial aid to education program, that is, of elementary and secondary education. To be sure, it went to limited areas, and it has been subject to a good deal of criticism, because it meant substantial federal economic assistance to some states, some school districts, and some areas, rather than general aid to education. But I justify this aid, this particular legislative proposal, on the basis that it was needed at the time for a special, for circumstances that were unusual. It was designed originally as a overall aid for school construction. It was another one of the proposals in a package of federal aid to education. There were other legislative proposals providing aid, general aid to education, other than than school construction. My program of 1950 started out for aid to school construction. It ended with aid to school construction for some schools, and aid to education for some schools. And those were schools in military reservations, near defense plants, where there were large numbers of federal workers, or where the federal government was making a substantial economic impact upon an area. And oftentimes this aid to education came where the federal government had large installations that paid no taxes, and therefore gifts in lieu of taxes to educational establishments were given. This was a beginning in aid to education, and it blossomed into the National Defense Education Act in the 1950s, to which I made substantial contribution in terms of amendments, as well as being one of its co-sponsors. And then in the general aid to elementary and secondary education of the 1960s. My legislative career has been marked with a keen and long-term interest and keen continuing and long-term interest in all forms of aid to education. This includes the National Science Foundation. I was a co-sponsor of this legislation. The program of general aid to education, the program of the National Defense Education Act, the Library Services Act, the Library Construction Act, many different legislative proposals that related to education. I have always been a strong supporter of it, believing that we must have national goals in education, even though our school system is locally operated and administered. It has always been my view that the mobility of our people, the age of the automobile and the airplane, require that there be some uniform standards of educational performance and excellence. A second program with which my name is associated and in which I take justifiable pride is the use of American food for purposes of foreign policy and for humanitarian purposes. My first effort in this was the emergency aid to India for wheat, emergency wheat to India. This I started in 1950 or 51. India at the time was represented in the United States by Madam Pandit, P-A-N-D-I-T. I had found out through an American officer that served in India and then subsequently in the State Department by the name of Joe Sparks, that India was suffering a tragic famine. I received a letter one day from a Methodist bishop in India. His name escapes me for the moment. And he outlined to me the tragic food situation in India, the hunger and the famine that was taking place. It was right at this particular time that American agriculture was producing fantastic surpluses of American food. Now those surpluses came in need and were very useful during the Korean War. But immediately after that war, there was a huge surplus of American agricultural cereal grains and other food products. I was able, while President Truman was in office, to get through this first aid to India of 4 million tons of American wheat. We went through many a problem with it. At first, in order to get some action, I appealed over national radio. Television was not very much in use at that time, over national radio for funds to buy wheat to send to India. This is before I could get any government action. I was able to get the National Red Cross to serve as the agency to receive the funds and to purchase the wheat and to ship the wheat. A large quantity of wheat was purchased, and it was shipped out of American ports and American ships for India. I aroused the interest of young people by asking college students across the nation to help and encourage the people in their local communities and colleges to contribute to Wheat for India. In fact, college students came to Washington by the hundreds, leaving little token bags of wheat on the doorstep and in the offices of the Indian Embassy. I met with all of the voluntary organizations, called in the presidents of the many different voluntary organizations in the United States, and asked them to concentrate some of their attention and efforts upon the food needs of the people of India. When I look back at this, I wonder how I dared to do it. I was a very young senator, having no particular power or prestige in the Senate, but I did understand the needs of people. And Bishop Pickett, that was his name, the Methodist bishop in India, had kept me informed as to the terrible plight of the Indian people. I was keenly interested in India as a free nation and felt that the food shortage might very well imperil her continued freedom and democracy. I also felt that here was a situation where the plight of the American farmer could become a benefit to the hungry Indian citizen. In other words, our farmers were suffering because they were producing too much, and the Indians were suffering because they were producing too little. It seemed to me that by bringing together these two elements of related misery, that we could make a positive good or a positive achievement. I designed legislation for aid to India, and how well I recall its reception. When I put the legislation in, I received a rejection from the State Department. I recall at the time that Dean Acheson was Secretary of State and that Jim Webb was the Under Secretary of State. I went to see Mr. Webb, and was told that there was no provision in the President's program for such a proposal. I believe that I was also told by both Mr. Webb and Mr. Acheson that they had serious doubts as to whether or not the Congress would ever authorize such legislation and appropriate the funds for it. There were even comments made from the Bureau of the Budget at the time, and maybe that's where Webb was, I'm not sure now, that the farmers of America would be for it. On that note, I reacted, telling officers of the executive branch, whether in the State Department or the Bureau of the Budget, that as far as I was concerned, they didn't know a damn thing about farmers. I was brash, I'm sure, but I was also right. I pointed out that farmers liked to produce, and they didn't much care who bought it just so they got rid of it. And farmers were producing wheat, and at the same time, the The excess production of wheat was depressing farm prices and injuring the American farmer, and that we found ourselves in the strange predicament of having an overabundance of wheat at a time when the world was starving, when large numbers of the people in the world were starving, and that this overabundance of wheat was also depressing the American agricultural market. So I said, why don't we do something? I didn't get any place with the standard offices of government, the Bureau of the Budget of the State Department. But one day I took, when Bishop Pickett came to town, I asked for an appointment for the bishop with President Truman. And the bishop met with the president, and he told the president of the tragic story of famine in India. I was with him. And I asked the, and I then spoke to, later spoke to President Truman about my proposed legislation and said, Mr. President, this legislation will not only help the Indian people and strengthen our case in India and our hand in India, but it will also help the American farmer. He listened and he said, well, Hubert, it sounds to me like it's all right. Why don't we do something about it? And I said, I've been trying to. He said, well, you go over to the State Department and talk to Dean Acheson and the others over there, and I'm sure they'll give you their support. I said, I've been there, Mr. President, and they have not given me support. He said, well, why don't you go back again? He said, they may change their mind. And I learned another lesson about government, that the officers of the State Department, while they do have their own views, are also servants of the President. And when I went back to the State Department the second time, I found that they were very enthusiastic over my proposal and were willing to give it support. Now, in order to get it through the Congress, I had to share this proposal, the sponsorship of this proposal, with senators from the other side. Senator Herbert Lehman of New York was my co-sponsor on the Democratic side, and we took Senator Smith of New Jersey and one other senator, escapes me for the moment, and made them co-sponsors, so that the legislation was bipartisan. And as a result of this, we were able to get it through the Congress. We were able to authorize the shipment of 4 million tons of emergency wheat aid to India, and a very successful operation took place. This was the beginning, as I say, of my interest in the use of foodstuffs as a tool of foreign policy in areas vital to American interests, and also as a humanitarian resource at a time when the world was hungry and there was starvation in many lands. In 1953, I believe it was, I tried to amend the Mutual Security Act of that year by providing that a certain sum of the funds of the Mutual Security Act be dedicated to the shipment of food as a part of our foreign aid program. I drew up the amendment. I presented it to the Foreign Relations Committee, of which I was just a new member. As I recall, I was able to get it adopted in the committee. And then the administration turned against us. And that was then the Eisenhower administration with Mr. Stassen as the Director of Mutual Security. A bitter fight took place in the Senate. I had pointed out that when I introduced my amendment, that Mr. Stassen was for it. And now that it was looked like it might pass, and since it wasn't an administration proposal, they had turned against it. Since that part of the testimony in the Foreign Relations Committee was in executive session, I was to be denied the opportunity to have it read in the Senate chamber, because executive session testimony is secret. I raised such a fuss about it, however, that rather than to violate the rules of what we call executive meetings, my Republican colleagues agreed that something should be done, and we were able to amend able to keep in the Mutual Security Act of 1954 or 53 the First Amendment for the use of food as an instrument of American economic aid. We'd had food as humanitarian aid in UNRWA. We'd had food as humanitarian aid in UNICEF. And the United Nations special appeals. This was the first time that we'd attached to the Mutual Security Act itself a section for the use of food as a part of our economic assistance, compelling the government of the United States to reach into our surplus stockpiles of food and use food for purposes of economic development. In 1954, in the Committee on Agriculture and Forestry, of which I was a member, we proceeded to take this amendment and develop it into major legislation known as Public Law 480. Now, Public Law 480 had the sponsorship of Senator Schepel of Kansas, as I recall. I was one of its co-sponsors. It was a bipartisan measure, but it came out of the committee as a Republican bill because the Republicans had a majority on the committee at the time. Its genesis, however, was the aid to India and the amendment to the Mutual Security Act. And all during my Senate career, I maintained a close, watchful eye and abiding interest in what we call Public Law 480, or Food for Peace. That law was expanded. It was, there were additions made to it, innovations, adjustments, so that we were able to use Food for Peace for many things, including not only economic development, but educational services, medical services, a host of activities under several titles of that bill. Title 1, 2, and 3, and 4, all these titles related to specific uses of American food overseas. This program has been responsible for the export of hundreds of millions of dollars of American agricultural products. It has helped stabilize domestic American, domestic agricultural markets. It has been a great help to the American farmer in giving him a better price for his commodities. But more importantly, it has permitted the orderly distribution and use of an abundance of food and fiber at a time when the world was desperate for it and when our capacity to produce it was practically unlimited. It was not only good economics, it was good international politics. It was not only good international politics, it was good sense and good morality. It has been one of the most successful programs of the government of the United States, both at home and abroad, helping our domestic economy, helping the American farmer, and helping particularly the developing countries, those countries in Africa and Asia and South America that where food shortages were resulted in the use of scarce hard currency, and where we were able to help relieve those food shortages. We were able to leave in those countries the hard currency that they needed for economic and industrial development. We were able to generate what are called PL 480 funds, or counterpart funds. Here's the way it worked. If we shipped 1 million tons of wheat to a country, that 1 million tons that were there at a negotiated price would be paid for in the currency of that country. And that currency would be put on deposit to the account of the United States. And then, that having been done, the country that bought the wheat or received it would enter into negotiations with the government of the United States as to how to use that particular sum of money which was in our account. In other words, the money was then loaned back at interest to the country for economic development. It was not hard currency or convertible currency. For example, in Poland, it would be Polish zlotys. In India, it would be Indian rupees. In Spain, it would be Spanish pesetas. So there was always the local currency that could be used only in limited areas, to be sure. But it provided some resources for the development of a country. Then, too, a certain amount of the currency was reserved to pay the costs of American activities in the country, the costs of our embassy, thereby reducing the dollar outlay from our own country. Then a certain amount of this currency was used to loan to American companies that might be willing to establish a new industry or a new economic activity in the foreign country. Our American company would therefore be able to get money from our government at a reasonable rate of interest to be invested in a foreign country, all of which meant that we had some chance to earn returns on American investment and thereby improve our economic situation. the Food for Peace program, in other words, converted food into health, food into education, food into ports and railroads and highways. It was used to pay the wages of workers who worked on these projects. It was the Food for Peace program made possible the conversion, literally, of wheat into dollars, into foreign currency, into new markets, because market development was one of the purposes of the program. I've had a hand in this legislation from its inception, and it is one of the, what I consider to be one of the bright spots of my legislative career. Now I'm going to discuss the structure of the Senate, the variety of personalities to be found in the Senate, and how the rules of the Senate operate to promote constructive dialogue and discussion. The question that I have is, isn't there a need for a variety in the Senate? Various types provide different stimuli to public debate and policy. Isn't that right? Would you want all Wayne Morris's, or any more than you would want all Alan Ellender's? This gives me a lead now for my discussion. Well, the Senate is made up of 100 prima donnas, 100 equals, all whom feel they are separate and just a little bit more than equal, or they wouldn't be in the Senate. I think it is fair to say that those persons who are elected to the Senate are a rather, as a group, a rather gifted and talented group. They didn't get there, over at least most of them, by accident. They came there through the political process. They were elected by the majority of the citizens in their state. They obviously had something going for them back home in their constituency, or they wouldn't have been elected. Many of the members of the Senate have illustrious careers in the law, in agriculture, in teaching, in business, in a host of professional and semi-professional activities. The study of the Senate itself, as to the senators' age, their religions, their backgrounds, their education, their professions, their avocations and vocations, will give you about as good a cross-section of the American public as you would find if you went out to just review the demography of the American people. What kind of people are they? Senators are neither saints nor devils. They are neither genius nor nitwits. They are, I think, a cut above the average, and most of them are able people, with some of them having unique capacities, qualities, and talents. I also find that senators generally develop when they come to Washington. I watched senators as the presiding officer of the Senate for 4 years, particularly watching younger senators grow and develop in the Senate. I have, when I was majority whip of the Senate, I took a keen interest in helping younger members of the Senate, new members, become acquainted with the procedures of the Senate and to give them some advice and counsel out of my own experience, because I'd made more than my fair share of mistakes and also had had some accomplishments which I believe merited some respect. There is a great variety in the Senate, not only because there are two political parties, but because there are individualists in each of these political parties. Within the Republican Party, there are the conservatives. Some of them are very conservative. And there are liberals, and some of them very liberal. Within the Democratic Party, the same situation prevails. But each senator is a character unto himself, and not only that, but each senator has to represent a state, and indeed, in many instances, a cultural pattern, or an attitude, or a social environment. He is not merely himself. He is somewhat of a reflection of his constituency. So that when you judge the Senate of the United States, you do not judge it merely on the biographical backgrounds of the senators, but you also have to judge it or evaluate it in terms of where these senators come from. What were the influences on their life? And what are the influences at work in the state that they represent? What are the social attitudes? What are the prevailing problems? What is the historical background of the state? Is it agrarian, agricultural primarily, or is it urban? And if it is urban, is it white, or is it black, or is it a balance? And if it is it an area that is arid, or is it one that suffers from floods? Is it one that is gifted with many natural resources of minerals and timber? Or is it one that is primarily just agricultural or primarily urban and industrial? All of these matters must be taken into account. I think that Alexis de Tocqueville did the best job of analyzing the influence of topography, geography, climate, social attitudes upon politics of any writer on the American scene. But the Senate of the United States, if you observe it carefully, will give you as good a social x-ray, a social picture, like an x-ray, of the country as you will find. To be sure, the House of Representatives, because it is much larger, gives it in more detail. But senators are able to represent both the long-term interests of a country, a region, or a state because of their six-year term, and also, as they come closer to the election, the immediate needs. They have, in other words, both the qualities of statesmen and the constant campaigner who is seeking re-election. Is there a need for variety? I should say so, because our country is varied and diverse and diversified. We are not a homogeneous people, we are a heterogeneous people. In fact, it would be better if there was even greater variety in the Senate, particularly of racial and ethnic groups. However, today the Senate has people of Asian background, it has people that are of African background, it has people of every race, and of every race, creed, and religion in the United States. So it does mirror somewhat the public scene. And it is this diversity of personalities, of interests, of political attitudes that really give life and meaning to our democracy. The Senate is without a doubt a unique political forum. It has both the qualities of stability and spontaneity. It has the qualities of conservative discussion as well as at times frenzied debate. It can be parochial and it can be, in a sense, universal. Senators are, in a sense, more immune from pressures of the immediate than their counterparts in the House of Representatives. The six-year term, which was conceived by our founding fathers and so beautifully discussed by Madison and others in the Federalist Papers, has given a degree of parliamentary stability to the American political system, which is both healthy and regenerative, as well as conservative in the best sense, namely conserving that which we have and being willing to be innovative at the same time. The Senate does provide, under its rules, time for debate. One of the arguments for the so-called unlimited debate is that it does give protection against an emotional frenzy of the hour, that it permits just a few senators to call the Senate to attention, to say, in other words, wait a minute, don't hurry, let's take another look. This is one of the arguments that has been used repeatedly and quite successfully in support of the right of unlimited debate. And historical examples have been brought forward where there is a wave of emotion throughout the country that could have precipitated very severe and dangerous law had it not have been for the fact that certain senators who are privileged to have a six-year term and thereby to ride out the storms of immediate public opinion and to survive it and to live for another day that those senators would take the floor, engage in debate, ventilate the question, hold the nation's attention until some semblance of reason and balance came into the public discussion or into the public arena. This is the best argument for the right of unlimited debate. But the Senate does permit debate in its best sense. Senators can speak on any topic. Recently, the rule of germaneness has been applied. But there's always time given in each day for the widest expression of views. And what a senator says and what he thinks is his business, as long as he does not engage in any personal attack upon the character or the motives of any of his colleagues, or indulge in any kind of attack upon the state, upon a state. In other words, as long as he stays within the rules of the Senate, rules which are designed to promote orderly debate, rules which are designed to curb emotions and to lend themselves to rational discussion, as long as he does that, he can discuss anything from the making of bean soup to traveling to the moon. Now, there are those that ridicule the Senate for its dilatory tactics, for the delays, for all of the less than significant material that's placed in the congressional record, for the speeches that are delivered for home consumption, for the trivia that characterizes much of the day's work. I would only suggest this, that every day does not require that there be a statesmanlike address in the Senate. Were it to be so, it would become so commonplace that it no longer would have significance. Sometimes it is the flood of trivia which acts as the background which sets out the more important messages that are delivered and the more important debates that are engaged in, in which senators become engaged. When there is important legislation, it is debated, and senators generally are capable of presenting powerful and at times moving arguments. The congressional record is one of the most informative documents published anywhere in the world. And much of what is in there is the result of long and serious research, as well as the innate ability of some of the senators and congressmen to sense the needs of the day and to perfect or at least to design solutions that will make some, or remedies that will make some impact upon those needs. Yes, we need men in the Senate that are different. We need a Wayne Morris who is willing to debate an unpopular issue and take an unpopular stand and compel those who oppose him to refine their arguments and to present their case with meticulous care. You need an Alan Ellender, who is a watchdog of the Treasury, who has gained a reputation for picking on little things. Many times it is the little things that cause great troubles, unless they are corrected early. And I suppose that Senator Ellender, with all of his, what some people call, penny-pinching economy cuts, I happen to believe that the senator has done more good than bad. He has compelled senators to take another look at the dollars that they're spending, to take another look at staff that they're hiring. There is a tendency in the Congress of the United States, when you're dealing with other people's money, to become careless. And you need watchdogs of the Treasury. You need people who are plain, downright, petty, and mean about it, in order to get you to understand that this money doesn't grow on trees. Furthermore, it is my judgment that there is a tendency on the part of members of Congress, and in particular their staffs, to become very wasteful with public funds. Wasteful in little things which translate themselves into bigger things. And thank goodness for people who will put the check rein on them. But you also need senators who are willing to look ahead, who are willing to discuss things that have yet not come to the public notice. And the Senate provides that forum. I've always said that each senator who has that 6-year term owes 4 years of that term to the Lord and his country, and possibly 2 years to himself and his chance for re-election. Now that's a crude rule of thumb, but a 6-year term does permit a senator to think ahead, to be creative, to design new proposals, to test them in the crucible and in the refiner's fire of debate, to go on out and see what the public thinks about his views. A man can start out in the first year of his Senate career with a number of new proposals and ideas or refinements of older ones, and find out whether or not they have any appeal to the public, whether he can muster some support for them, or whether he is on a lost cause, or whether he has really come up with nothing that's worthwhile. The 6-year term, not only provides that opportunity to resist the emotion and frenzy of the moment, to resist the current pressures of current political attitudes, and to resist the pressures of even constituents and lobbyists. But that 6-year term provides you the opportunity to become a scholar in government, at least a well-grounded student. You don't have to do everything at once. You have time. And you can become acquainted with the processes of government as well as the tremendously complex social and economic issues which plague our country. Senators serve on committees, and those committees can be like daily seminars in a graduate school. In fact, you can bring before those committees the finest brains of the country, the most informed people of the nation and indeed of the world. And a conscientious senator can learn more in 1 year in the Congress than he could in 10 years at a graduate school at a university. It all depends on what he wants to do. He not only has the opportunity to hear what others have to say, he has the opportunity to cross-examine these men and women. He also learns from the mail that comes to his office and the visitors, the correspondence that he seems to overwhelm him. And may I say that a good senator is one that will write, that will want to know what is in that correspondence so that he has a sort of temperature chart of the public fever and public attitude. Senators need to keep in mind, however, that there are little things, the minutiae that has to be taken care of. And a senator that does his job well is one that will not only be interested in the great things and the big things of government, of society, the things that relate to education and foreign policy and health, fiscal policy, monetary policy, but he'll also be interested in the immediate needs of his constituents. And it's by taking the time to know something about those immediate needs of your constituents that politics takes on reality. Otherwise, you're apt to be engaged in an intellectual dissertation, a discussion, without any real substantive information that tells you what is happening to people. After all, politics is about people. It's about community. And it isn't just a subject for leisure time dialogue and commentary. Politics is hard work. It's human relations. And a senator should be an expert in human relations, knowing what people think, why they think the way they do, what motivates them, and how he can, in a sense, satisfy the needs and the aspirations of at least a majority of his people, and hopefully much more than a majority. It is my view that most senators are hardworking and that they are far above the average in competence, that they tend to develop like anyone else does that's put to the test. It is also my view that there is a great deal of delay and dilatory activity in the Senate, which could be eliminated, and the many refinements relating to Senate structure and organization that could greatly improve the quality of work. Somewhere along the line, the Congress of the United States must have a massive system of information retrieval, data bank. It must be equipped to bring to bear on the decision-making process of the Congress the latest and up-to-date information. It does not have that facility today. It must be able to respond to the needs of its constituents. The Senate office must be able to respond to the needs and the requests of constituents. This I've emphasized before, and it always was a part of my, very important part of my Senate life. I believe that people are important, and while their letters may seem incoherent and their requests may seem at times even petty, they are at least the expressed needs and requests of a citizen, and that citizen is entitled to your service. Now, what are the pitfalls for a senator? Well, one pitfall is when he takes himself too seriously and begins to think that somehow or another he has a pipeline to God and is and has all-encompassing wisdom. A good senator is one that knows that he is learning every day and that there is much more to be learned. A senator that is growing is one that understands that his country is changing and that he must change with it, at least change in terms of the methods that he uses to keep abreast of the times and of the needs of his people. Pitfalls of senators are the human fallibilities, arrogance, power, bad social habits, money, drink, yielding to temptations of lobbyists and personal gain at the expense of public service. These are nothing new. They are as old as men and women themselves. But there is another pitfall, and that is if a senator looks upon his office as a place to relax, rest, and just enjoy life. A senator's life must be an active one. He must be willing to give of it for his country and his constituency, and he should look upon it as a constant daily challenge of expanding his areas of interest, of enriching his mind and spirit, and of seeking new ways and means to improve the processes of our parliamentary democracy. In other words, how to make government more responsive to the needs of the people, how to make government act more quickly and more and with greater alacrity or with greater speed. Today, there is a terrible frustration in our citizenry over government. They feel that government is so big that it is muscle-bound, and they are right. The senator must be willing to be the bridge, the conduit between the constituent and the executive branch of the government. And he must be constantly in a position of advocate for his constituents. He should look upon himself as the lawyer for the public, for his people, the people that he represents. The executive agencies of government are caught up in incredible amounts of bureaucratic red tape. They're big, they're overwhelmed with correspondence and requests. And a senator is the man that should be able to cut through that red tape to get at the people that can make decisions and to insist not only that a decision is made on an individual case, but that there be a refinement of the decision-making process itself and a constant improvement of it. It has been said that if you work too hard at your job as a senator, you are apt to forget your people back home and suffer defeat. Well, that depends upon whether in working too hard you forget the people back home. Now, if you forget them, and do not stay in touch with them, you can expect that they will forget you. It's a long ways from Washington to any place other than Washington. And people, and there is only so much news space and so much time on radio and television. And you are competing for it. What's more, people are inundated with letters and bulletins and magazines and papers these days. Therefore, a senator or a congressman must make up his mind that if he's going to be an effective senator, in fact, if he's going to be a re-elected senator or congressman, he will have to stay in touch with his people, his constituency. Now, there are many ways to do it. Some people do it by that personal touch of returning back home to their constituency regularly, traveling about their state, finding ways and means of meeting with a wide variety of people. Others do it by use of radio and television and through press releases. Others do it by a more effective political organization that does not require the personal presence of the senator. I happen to think it takes a combination of all of this. But I do know that a senator that tends to his mail, that tends to his constituents when they call on him at Washington, that gives personal attention to the people that he represents, that senator stands a very good chance of being reelected. Constituents are willing to let you have your own point of view as a senator. Constituents are even willing to disagree with you on a point of view and yet vote for you again if they think you're doing a good job and doing it honestly and from a sense of sincerity. But senators must never take for granted that they are popular. No political figure should. And if they are popular, they should look upon popularity as a line of credit to be drawn upon for important service to country and to people and nation. This is the way that I've seen my role in the Senate. And I do believe that a senator has much that he can contribute to government, because while he has great authority, he does not have the responsibility for the day-to-day operation of the government. That is in the executive branch. Therefore, a senator should be creative. He should be imaginative. He should be willing to pioneer. He should be willing to search out for new, to reach out and search for new answers to new and old problems. He ought to be not only a talker, but a listener. He ought to be a mover and a shaker, yes, of getting things done. But he also ought to be trying to find out how we can better get things done. So to me, that 6-year term in the Senate is not only a blessing, but it imposes a heavy responsibility. It doesn't mean that you can take it easy. What it means is that you have a special obligation to use those years in finding new ways and means to better improve the operation of government and to find answers to public and private problems. I've been asked, what are the problems of serving in the Senate without independent means? In other words, can you serve in the Senate without being rich? Of course you can. Most members of the Senate, or at least a number of them, are not men that are really rich. The Senate today provides for a good salary, and it provides a rather substantial amount for staff. When I first came to the Senate back in 1949, our salary was about $12,000, as I recall, with another $2,500 expense allowance. But of course, a dollar bought more then than it does now, but nevertheless, it was much less in real purchasing power than the present salary. And I recall that in those first years that I served in the Senate, I'd say at least the first 10 years, or 12 years, that I was hard pressed for income. I had to earn a good deal of money outside of my job, in lectures, in writing, in speeches, and I had to put a good deal of that back into my work, paying for travel, paying for reprints, paying for office supplies, and times paying for additional help. It is always better if you have independent means. I really think it makes you a much more independent man, but it is not required. Fortunately, today, the salary of a senator is sufficient for him to meet most of his bills, unless he is overextended. It means, in other words, that he can exercise some independence. We must make sure that it doesn't become, that the Senate doesn't become a rich man's club. In fact, American politics is in danger of becoming just that. The high cost of campaigns, the high cost of serving in public life. All of this tends to lend itself to the rich and the well-heeled. For this to become a pattern in American public life, I think would not only corrupt it, but I think would deny American public life some of the best talent that's available. Because that best talent is not always in the hands of those, is not always to be found in those who have the biggest bank account. Quite frequently, it is found in those who have little or no bank account and ought to have the right of public service. One of the central problems facing American politics is how it can be financed, how political campaigns can be financed without relying upon the gifts of big givers, special interest groups. This simply has to be overcome, or politics will become not only corrupted, but the special province, as I've said, of a handful of well-to-do, or those individuals who are willing to sell their souls to special interests in this country. Also, the cost of campaigning simply must be cut back, and severe limitations upon campaign expenditures must be enacted into law. And those laws must be enforceable and enforced. The Corrupt Practices Act, which is presently on the books, is almost useless, and in many ways lends itself to corruption. It is a meaningless bit of legislation that has been abused and misused and violated repeatedly. So our democracy faces a very stern test in the days ahead, and I mean in the immediate days ahead, of how we can provide for campaign financing of an election without corrupting the political process or distorting it in the favor of special interest groups. Now, for a senator to do his job, he must have adequate income. And the fact that the Senate salary has been raised has made this possible. This does not mean that a senator should not or could not earn additional income. Many of them require it. I find, for example, that my own obligations have grown by the year. I suppose it can be said that one's standard of living tends to increase, and it surely is more costly. Therefore, it may be necessary to have additional outside income, but this must be reported, must be a matter of public knowledge or of public information, and how it is obtained must also be a matter of public information. In other words, does the income come from writing, from lectures? Does it come from investments? Or does it come from serving on a board? Or from business profits or dividends? What is its source? Once that the information is reported, then I think a public servant, an elected official, has fulfilled his public and private responsibilities. I don't think there ought to be a limit on a man's income, nor do I think there ought to be any limits on where he gains his, from whence he gains his income. The enforcement or the discipline should come from the fact that it is public knowledge as to where he gets his income and how much he has. Now, one of the most difficult assignments that a United States senator has is how does he serve, in a sense, two masters? By that I mean, how does he serve the national interest as a senator of the United States of America and the local or constituent interest as the senator, the United States senator from his state, like myself, the United States senator from Minnesota? How do I balance off what I consider to be my national obligations as a citizen of the nation and as a United States Senator and my obligations to my constituents who have sent me there to the Congress of the United States to represent them. Sometimes those demands are in conflict, or they appear to be. For example, many a senator has voted for foreign aid when the public opinion of his state, as insofar as one can measure it, is opposed to foreign aid. I found myself at times voting repeatedly for legislation which did not seem to have public support back home in Minnesota. This was not a particularly difficult problem for me because I felt I was doing what I wanted to do and what was right. But it poses a problem, and one that we ought to discuss. A United States Senator does have an obligation to take care of the needs of his own constituents. I established my office, or arranged my office in such a way that the requests of my constituents for service from the government, for information from the government, for action by the government on their needs or requests were readily handled. In other words, I served as a bridge, a conduit, an activator between the constituent on the one hand and the executive branch of government and its agencies on the other. I assumed that my constituents' requests were legitimate, and I pressed the executive branch for action on those requests. When my constituent requests were relating to legislation, I weighed their requests very carefully. I felt that I had been sent to the Congress to help forward legislation, to create it, to write it, and to work for its adoption. In other words, I saw my role I saw the role of a senator as having several outlets or several points of action. Or a senator, to use another metaphor, wore several coats. One coat was that of the advocate of his constituent before the executive agencies. Another coat was the advocate of his constituents in the legislative body itself, fighting for the things that constituents had written to him about and talked to him about in the Senate itself and in the Congress. The third role, which I believe was more fundamental and important than all, was the role of a United States Senator in working for, hopefully contributing to, broad national policy that related to the political, economic, and social well-being of the entire nation. Now, here is where there was a great difference between some of us senators from the northern states and those from the southern states. One of the first things that I noticed or observed in my discussion with staff members of southern senators and southern senators themselves was how they viewed their role as a United States senator. I looked upon my role as a senator from Minnesota, as being a senator of the United States of America, elected, yes, by the people of Minnesota, sent there to represent, indeed, the interests of Minnesota. But above all, my superior obligation was to the nation, to the United States, that I was a citizen of the United States, which citizenship was more important to me than being a citizen of Minnesota. To be sure, my voting rights, at least up to this point, rested upon the fact that I was a citizen of my state. But I interpreted the Constitution as having two types of citizenship and one superior to another. You are a citizen of your state, to be sure, but you are also a citizen of the United States of America. And the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments made that very clear, and that the superior citizenship, the controlling citizenship, was that of the citizen of the U.S., of the United States. Therefore, when I was elected as a United States Senator, I considered my basic obligation to the nation. And if I had to judge on critical issues between what appeared to be the special requests or the special claims of my state as compared to the needs of the nation. I came down on the side of the needs of the nation. Fortunately, that didn't happen too often, but it could happen, and one should be prepared to face it. My southern colleagues, some of them, would be much more concerned about their states than they were about the entire, than they appeared to be about the entire nation. Now, that may be an unfair and prejudiced judgment, but this is the way that it appeared to me. A senator from, let's say, Mississippi or South Carolina, at least the conservative Democratic senator or Republican, thought of himself primarily as representing his state. He was truly a state's rights man, and not what I would call a national senator. He was not only a senator from his state, he was a senator for his state. And while he served in the United States Congress, his evaluation or assessment of his role as a senator was primarily to be the representative of his state, like an ambassador in the United States Senate. I looked upon my role as, yes, to be sure, elected by the people of Minnesota to represent the state of Minnesota in our federal system in the Congress of the United States, but above all to keep in mind that there was a superior citizenship and a superior claim upon me and my service, and that was the citizenship of the nation and the claim of the nation upon my services, talents, and person. One of the problems that a senator has is, as I said, balancing off these local requirements and local responsibilities with that of his service in the broader context of the Congress and national legislative policy. I found that the people of my state were willing to expecting of me prompt service to their requests. That's in the beginning. That's primary. In other words, if a farmer's mail wasn't being delivered, and he wrote to me about it, he expected some answers and some action. If a citizen was having trouble getting his visa for a foreign trip or his passport and wrote to me, he expected some answers. Now, these are minor things. These are what we call case problems or individual requests. Surely a good Senate office will take care of these on a routine basis, but to take care of them promptly. It's this sort of service that tends to build constituent support and helps you in your re-election. Also, it's what's expected of you and what you ought to do. Then, too, your local constituents may very well have local legislative meetings. A state in which the dairy industry was very prominent as an economic enterprise, and indeed almost a way of life in our agriculture. Therefore, I had a special obligation to be constantly alert to the needs of the dairy farmers, the processors of dairy products, and I took care of those requirements. I considered that to be part of my duty as a United States Senator. But when it came to a question as to whether or not we ought to have provide under foreign aid cattle breeding stock for other countries in the developing areas of the world, which in turn might very well limit our exports of agricultural products to some of those countries, I felt that the national interest required that the foreign aid program be adopted and that the dairy breeding stock be provided. Now, had I wanted to be strictly parochial and concerned only about local needs, I would have voted against the foreign aid. But it was, to me, the overriding national interest compelled me to, as a United States Senator, to support the foreign aid program. Frequently, we have this problem with foreign trade, where local interests are apparently being injured by foreign competition. And it poses a very difficult problem for members of Congress. I can understand how a member of the House of Representatives who has to face the electorate every 2 years would be more, would be under greater pressure to respond to the requests of his, of some areas of his constituency to impose quotas or tariffs or limitations. But a United States Senator that has a 6-year term should take a more careful look at it, at such a request for quotas or a restrictive trade policy. It may be that the problem which comes to the forefront that appears to necessitate legislation will be a problem that vanishes or is minimized over the next few years. And therefore, a senator can afford to take a senator can not only should a senator can afford to take a longer term look at the problem. In fact, he ought to, because one of the benefits of his Senate 6-year term, or one of the duties, I would say, of the 6-year term, is to think in terms of the national interest, to be able to ride out the storm of temporary public opinion, and to make judgments on what would be on what the nation might require for its own good in the future. I thought that I was able to balance this off quite well. But it is not easy. And one has to, and those who are the critics of members of Congress should be very tolerant of the members and their actions. Congressmen and senators are under terrific pressure at times from economic and political interests in their constituency that demand relief or demand attention at both the executive and legislative level. It's very difficult to know just when you're doing the right thing. My Senate career was characterized by a broad range of interest rather than specializing in one or two areas. There is considerable argument as to how a man serving in the Congress can best serve both his own political interests and his constituents' interests. Should he specialize, for example, in one or two areas, become known as an expert, such as in the field of taxation or foreign trade policy or conservation or housing? Or should he extend himself into several of these areas, sort of across the board? I received a good deal of advice on this subject when I first came to the Senate, and indeed during my entire Senate career. There were always those that felt that if a senator was to gain attention, to command the attention of his colleagues, of the press, and of certain interest groups in the country, he ought to specialize in a particular area. It may be only that he was a specialist in the subject of space or aeronautics, or it may be that he was a specialist in matters of health or education. but he ought not to spread himself too thin. This I was constantly reminded of, and I suppose in part because my Senate career was not trimmed to those limitations. I have many areas of interest, and I happen to think that my constituents had many areas of interest, and therefore I should not concentrate in particular upon one or two areas. I looked upon my legislative responsibilities as similar to providing a balanced diet for a family, not concentrating upon one dish or one particular menu, but rather to try to interest myself in the totality of of the needs and the requirements of the nation. I'm not at all sure that this is the better way, but it was the way that I liked it. I preferred, rather than to be a specialist in an area, to be a generalist. Just as the medical profession needs general practitioners, so I think the political area needs general practitioners. This doesn't mean that you are ill-equipped. In fact, to me, it means that you may be better balanced in your overall view of the nation's requirements and needs than a specialist would be. There's always a doubt, however, in the minds of your critics as to whether or not you can be so much involved in so many things and know anything about any one of them. Or to put it another way, because there is such a broad spectrum of interest in politics and so many subjects to be covered that affect a nation and a world, how can you be knowledgeable in any of these areas if you try to cover them, to cover most of them? It's a legitimate question, and for some people, I think it may have be applicable and have real meaning. The fact is that I think that I was capable of understanding a large number of areas and having better than a working knowledge of those areas. I read fast. I think I learn rather rapidly. I absorb information, and I was able to, and I have been and continue to be able to discuss a number of areas, particularly after any amount of research and study, and to cover those areas with some thoroughness. Furthermore, I've always remembered that old adage that experts should be on tap and not on top. I figured that as a senator, it was my job to be like a conductor of a symphony and not to be the flute player. That if I needed an expert, they were available, either in the Library of Congress, in the Legislative Reference Service, or on a committee staff, or on my own staff, or one that I might recruit from certain areas of the public or private domain. It was my job as a senator, as I saw the role of a senator, to know a good deal about many things, and possibly a little more about some things than others, but to be a generalist rather than to be a specialist. Now, you can argue this case either way. A number of members of Congress, particularly the House of Representatives, limit their areas of interest primarily to their committee assignments. In other words, if you're a member of the Committee on Agriculture in the House, you become much more vitally involved in agricultural policy. And a House member, having to come up for re-election every 2 years, doesn't have the time to be an overall generalist. But a senator does have the time. And I have a feeling that some senators become specialists because it doesn't take quite so much time as it does to be an active, knowledgeable, intelligent, informed general practitioner of the legislative arts. Anyway, I was pleased with my own decision. It brought me it gave to me what I wanted. I have an inquiring mind. I have a great interest in many things and many people. I like football and I like opera. I like to go to a nightclub and I like to go to church. I enjoy classical literature and I enjoy short stories. I like to read Harper's and I enjoy reading Playboy and Esquire. I like to, I'm keenly interested in science and technology, but I'm also interested in philosophy and poetry. Now, if this makes me an oddball, then that's what I am. But that's the way that my life has been, and that's the way it's going to continue to be. There is so much to know that I refuse to spend my time studying just one little element. I prefer to know much about a lot of things than to know all there is to know about one or two things. I let other people make their own decisions as to how they want to live. But this is the way I enjoy it. And in the Congress, this is the way I acted and served. I had a broad range of interest, yes, from fair trade or quality stabilization, to oceanography, to information retrieval, to food for peace, to the Peace Corps, to U.S.-Soviet relations, to aid to education, 101 things. And I involve myself in these matters with great enthusiasm and dedication. And I was able to bring into my service, or into the service of the Senate, a number of people who were very competent in these areas. I have always considered the Senate a constant learning process, or being a senator, a constant learning process. If it isn't that, then it's time to retire and get out of the way, because the world changes, and in order to keep up with it, you have to learn and constantly and have a constant flow of new information, new knowledge, and new ideas. I've been asked, how did I absorb and develop ideas in so many fields? I think the answer is that I have an inquiring mind, that I read a great deal, that I visit with people, that I do have an insatiable interest in what's going on. My reading has not always been in books, but in periodicals and journals and bulletins. And when I take an interest in a subject, I try to find out about it. Then, too, as a senator, you have the opportunity to meet people from every walk of life, if you'll seize that opportunity and make the most of it. You can frequently do this right in the committee sessions or committees where you are assigned or are working. Then, too, you have the chance to bring around you consultants and advisors. There are always people from the academic community, from business and labor, from the social services, who are willing to work with you, to give you their advice and counsel. Travel broadens one's views and opens up new vistas of thought. And I traveled I traveled a good deal as a senator, but I picked and selected the areas where I wanted to go. And they were not junkets. They were actually trips of study and concentrated effort. And on these journeys, I would take elaborate notes and prepare reports for the executive agencies of government that might be interested in these areas, for the committees of the Congress, and for myself. In other words, travel and visiting and observing was another part of the learning process. bringing to my mind new ideas and at least a better understanding of the problems that beset us. But I mentioned the staff of a senator, and a good staff can be of immense help to you. And once that you get good committee assignments and have any seniority, you are generally able to supplement your regular Senate staff by some very competent people who become members of committee staffs. I had this good fortune. Also, I depended on my staff to do a good deal of research, to bring to my attention new ideas, articles, speeches, news stories, keeping me up to date. I then also feel that if you are under some pressure to, give interviews, to participate in television and radio programs, you do a better job. Because you want to do well on these programs and in your interviews, and therefore you prepare yourself for them. I found that I was able to concentrate a great deal of attention upon a broad spectrum of issues when I was preparing for a TV or radio show. Of course, you have to organize yourself in your office so you have the material for the preparation, for the intensive schooling and training that you need before you go on a radio or a television show or enter into a major interview. It's sort of like cram studying, to be sure, but it produces results. It gives you a wide range of it gives you a broad understanding of what is going on at the time and compels you to think ahead as to what others might ask you and what you might provide as a new thought or a new idea. But a senator can become very dependent on his staff if he permits it to happen, particularly if he's rather lazy or feels that he's too busy to take care of things. I think a good senator has to be in charge of his staff, that he has to look upon them strictly as advisors and not as junior senators or associate senators. Staff is prone, at least professional staff, has a tendency to want to think of itself in terms of being a sort of an associate senator. I believe that you have to remind your staff that their function is to advise and counsel you, and that the decisions to be made will be your decisions. And you also have to remind yourself that this requires your attention and your willingness to take on some of the hard tasks of decision making. A number of senators do become almost the captive of a number of members of Congress, or let's put it this way, members of Congress can become captives of their staff, where a staff keeps away people that ought to see you, keeps from you ideas that ought to get to you, shields you from the just and constructive criticism that you might very well deserve or ought to have. Then, staff can make you feel that everything is going just fine because the staff is taking care of the problems or taking care of the details of the office. It's one thing to take care of details, which is the role of a staff. It's another thing for staff to begin to feel that they are the elected senator. And believe me, that can happen. I've been asked, how did a man, for example, like Bobby Baker, get so much power and influence? Here was Robert Baker, secretary to the majority in the Senate. And there is no doubt but what he was a man of considerable talent and influence. Why? Well, first of all, he was a man of talent. He was deeply immersed in politics. It was his life. He was always available to help senators and other staff members. I cannot overemphasize the importance in the Congress of just being available, being present at committee meetings, being present in the Senate, being there when the votes are taken, when the debate is underway, being in your office, being on the job. because so many are away that when you're there, you have just that much extra influence. For example, if you're on a subcommittee of 5, 3 makes a quorum. If 2 members are away, that means that your vote, instead of being 1/5 of the vote, becomes 1/3. You exercise just that much more influence. A man once asked me, what is it that gives a senator influence and power in the Senate? And my answer was, in a large measure, just being there, tending to business, being there to offer amendments, to vote on them one way or another, for them or against them, to be there to help rewrite legislation. Most legislation is written in committee. And if you're not there in committee to do your job and to make your contribution, you'll have a much more difficult time doing what you would like to do or making any adjustments or amendments when offered in the Senate as a body. Your influence and your strength basically is in the committees. And while you always have the prerogative and the right of offering amendments, speaking, and of voting on legislation in the Senate itself, it is a matter of congressional fact and history that most legislation that comes from committees goes through the Congress untouched, unamended. Therefore, committee work is vital. And in the committees, you depend a great deal on staff. So staff has a unique function to perform and can, in many instances, actually write the legislation unless a senator is on the job, knowing what the legislation is all about, understanding its intricacies, and is willing to take the time to do the job of legislating rather than leaving it to staff. Remember, staff is perfectly willing to take on the job. But the people that have the responsibility are the elected representatives. If they forfeit that responsibility or duty to someone else, you can rest assured that it will be readily accepted. Politics is another word for power. And when a man vacates it, someone else takes it. When a person refuses to do, when a person either avoids or evades or runs away from what he is supposed to do, and thereby leaving a vacuum of power, someone moves into that vacuum and seizes the power and uses it. Sometimes it's another senator, sometimes it's a president, sometimes it may be a staff member, and that's where staff frequently gains its strength. Now, Bobby Baker was a unique individual. He understood the Senate as few men ever have understood it. He knew the members of the Senate and knew them intimately. And regardless of party, he was a friend to them and always at their beck and call, always ready, willing, and able to serve, doing the little things, providing, for example, and finding a room for a luncheon that a senator might have. When that senator's own office staff was unable to obtain or provide the facilities. He was there when a member of Congress, a member of the Senate, wanted to get a hold of somebody in the executive branch and didn't quite know to whom to talk. Bobby Baker would find out the man that ought to be talked to and would set up the appointment or the telephone conversation. He was there to see that senators were never embarrassed by being absent. For example, on a roll call vote, if a senator was delayed getting to the Senate floor, Bobby would see to it that the vote was slowed down, that the roll call was delayed until Mr. Senator could make it and thereby be recorded. He watched for the little things, all of which were terribly important to individual senators. And he was there all the time, constantly in the Senate, watching over what was going on and knowing more about the day's proceedings than possibly any other single individual. It's because of these characteristics and attributes and this attention to detail that he exercised great influence in the Senate itself. For example, if a senator wanted to know what the bill was all about when on a particular vote, when that particular senator didn't have a chance to really study the bill or didn't know just what point, what section of the bill was being considered, Bobby Baker could give that senator in a few minutes or seconds a review of this of the parliamentary situation, would give a factual appraisal of the bill, would say what the amendment was about, who had offered it, who was supporting it, and who was opposing it, and thereby giving the senator an objective report so that Mr. Senator could then cast his vote as he wished. Yet, if the majority leader needed an extra vote on a bill, he could rely on Bobby to go out and get it, because he had done so many favors for so many senators that he oftentimes was able to get a senator to vote a particular way or the way in which the majority leader wanted it. Bobby Baker was a constant source of strength to any majority leader and to the majority party in the Senate. But as Lyndon Johnson said, that during the time that he was majority leader, that he called the shots, that he made the assignments to Bobby Baker, that Bobby had to report to him that he did not operate independently from the majority leader. Bobby Baker's trouble came when he was no longer in such close contact with the majority leader, when he was operating more on his own and began to think more in terms of his own interests rather than in the Senate's. In other words, he became so accustomed to the Senate and to his influence and the use of his influence in the Senate that he actually gave less attention to the Senate's business and started to put his talents to work in his own interests, in his own economic interests. And it was here where he got in trouble, when he started to mix his own special desires and special business interests with his professional political responsibilities, sacrificing his political responsibilities to the Senate and maximizing his personal opportunities, his economic opportunities for himself. And then mixing the two, using political influence to help himself and to help others, not on votes, not on legislation, but on making money and upon economic pursuits. Nevertheless, he was a talented man, and without a doubt, one of the most influential and helpful. Members of the Senate staff. Now, I've discussed how Lyndon Johnson operated as majority leader. Okay. Speaking of Bobby Baker, he had his favorites, and certain senators had looked to him for special favors. One of these men was Senator Robert Kerr. Kerr was a very powerful figure in the Senate. He was big physically. He had a booming voice. He had great self-confidence. He was in many ways a bully, but he was also a very competent and able senator. And Bobby Baker was oftentimes at and Bobby Baker, I think, was much attracted to him, and he to Bobby. The two of them seemed to hit it off. And there is no doubt that that Bob Kerr had a great fondness for Baker, and that Bobby Baker did many things to be of help to Robert Kerr. I say many things. Kerr didn't need more money, so the things that Bobby did for Kerr were primarily political, helping him to get legislation through, helping him particularly on matters relating to the Finance Committee of the Senate. Bobby, while he was really the secretary to the majority, became a special staff assistant, incognito, ex officio, to a man like Senator Robert Kerr. And there is no doubt but what Kerr befriended him in many ways. This all came out later on, of course, in some of the charges leveled at Baker. Kerr had a tremendous influence in the Senate because of his contacts, not only with members of Senate staff, but with the majority leader, with Clinton Anderson, with Warren Magnuson, with many of the committee chairmen. Kerr had unlimited self-confidence, and he also had a lot to back it up. He'd been in public life a long time. He'd been an active Democrat and a powerful figure in the Democratic Party. And he never had the quality of shrinking from either responsibility or from a claim. He was out in front and made no bones about it. He was a man of power and he exercised power. He knew what he wanted and he went after it. And sometimes in the process of doing it, he left many scars and left many wounds. Now, I wish to add a few more observations about Lyndon Johnson as majority leader. How he operated, how he built his power base, how he got things done. Some of this will be repetitious. The first thing to know about him is that he knew the operation of Congress. His experience as a congressman gave him insight into not only congressional personalities, congressional staff, but the total operation of the Congress itself. He knew where its resources were, the different avenues of information, how to use a committee staff and structure, how to use agencies of the government. And besides that, having been in Washington over a period of time, people who once served in the legislative branch found their way into the executive branch. And Lyndon Johnson kept those contacts. Therefore, he had lines of information going back and forth between Congress and executive offices, particularly amongst the regulatory agencies and the established departments of government. I'm sure that Lyndon Johnson's contacts during the Roosevelt years paid off handsomely in terms of prestige and influence and information during his role as majority leader. He knew people around Washington. He knew the key people of the media. He knew the business leaders and the business community. There is no substitute for experience, and there is no substitute for time in gaining experience. And Lyndon Johnson had had plenty of time in Washington, and he had gained a good deal of experience during that time. He used his time, however. And as I said earlier, being a confidant of and a protege of Sam Rayburn, being close to the Southern Bloc and yet not being a captive of them, captive of it, he had built-in power and influence. Lyndon Johnson seldom worked with groups in the Senate. That is, seldom met with groups. He met with individuals who were leaders of groups. For example, in his contacts with me, he felt that I was a leader of some of the liberal forces, or at least an articulate spokesman. He also knew that I had contacts outside of the Congress that could be very helpful within the Congress. My close working relationship with the labor movement was something that he depended upon, and he looked to me as a source of strength from the labor movement. Lyndon Johnson was friendly with organized labor, but organized labor didn't always trust Lyndon Johnson as a senator and as a majority leader. The important thing about Johnson is he knew this, and Rather than to try to ingratiate himself with all elements of labor, even though he had personal good friends like David Dubinsky in the ranks of labor, he depended on allies to bring labor support when it was needed. And I was that contact and that ally of his. Just as I learned a great deal from Johnson, he gained a great deal from me. I wasn't always able to deliver liberal Senate votes. Indeed, that was literally impossible. But I was able to interpret to Johnson what my liberal friends in the Senate were talking about, what their concerns were, and I honestly represented their concerns to Johnson. For example, I constantly pressed him on the importance of his giving more recognition to the liberals and not always playing to the Southerners. I pushed for certain committee assignments for some of our Northern Democratic Senate colleagues. I would urge Johnson to take up certain bills and to give us support on those bills. He did not play to the liberal view or to the liberal group. I would say that he bent to the South, but tried to play it down the middle, depending upon allies in the North and the South to bring him the support that he needed. He was a master strategist and technician, but that strategy and that and those tactics depended upon his close working relationship with a number of key senators, and I was one of them. Johnson used his office and his time to advantage. He had people spread all through the structure of the Senate in the key committees. As majority leader, he exercised tremendous power and authority, both with the executive branch of government and the Congress itself. As majority leader, he worked closely with the Speaker and with the majority leader of the House. His contacts with them were most of the time social, but the social contacts always turned out to be of political importance. When I say social, I don't mean out on the dinner circuit. I mean at lunch in the Capitol. I mean going over to what was known as the school board, where certain key members of the House and the Senate would gather together several times a week to have a drink around 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening. Senator Johnson always spent time with the minority leader, whether it was Bill Noland or Everett Dirksen or Bob Taft. He wanted to know what they were up to. He wanted to get their measure by being in contact with him, and this he did. He always outsmarted Bill Noland. I'm sure that he felt that he was capable of doing it. But when it came to Dirksen, he had met his match in terms of tactics and cunning. And he respected Dirksen. And during his presidency, he often called upon Dirksen and kept in very close touch with him. Johnson would never hesitate to call in anyone that he thought could be of help to the accomplishment of his objectives. I recall during the Eisenhower years that Johnson gave his own State of the Union message to the Democratic caucus, and then would do so in the Senate itself. In other words, listing out what he had as the Democratic objectives. He always insisted, however, that Democrats under his leadership act responsibly and not engage in vitriolic personal attack and who engage in just plain cheap personal politics. His word was responsibility, and he emphasized this word. And he not only emphasized the word, but the action. Now, I want to discuss for a while my role as Senate Whip. The term Majority Whip simply means Deputy Majority Leader. It's Assistant Majority Leader. How did I come to attain this position? Well, I recall that after the election of 1960, I received a call from Lyndon Johnson saying to me that there was consideration being given to nominate me for majority leader. He wanted to know if I was interested, and I told him, of course I was. He said, well, we need to have someone working with Mike Mansfield. Mike is going to be the majority leader, since he was majority whip, and there generally is a movement of succession. And apparently, and after all, Mike Mansfield had been chosen by Lyndon Johnson as the majority whip when he, Lyndon Johnson, was majority leader. By the way, I want to comment about that a little later, because I was involved in some of the maneuvers that took place when Mansfield became majority whip. But in 1960, following the election, I was asked in the early days of 61, just before the new Congress met, whether or not I would be willing to, whether or not I was interested in being majority whip. I said, indeed, I was. I'm sure that the suggestion came from Lyndon Johnson, who felt that I had some leadership qualities. And both Lyndon Johnson, then vice president, and John Kennedy, president, recommended me for this position. Of course, when Johnson became vice president, he still tried to maintain considerable control of the Senate Democrats as he had when majority leader. This was short-lived, however, and it was a miscalculation on his part. I can recall very well meeting with Lyndon Johnson and Bob Kerr, Bobby Baker, Mike Mansfield, Dick Russell, and a few others over at the to discuss the role of Lyndon Johnson as in the Democratic caucus. Should he, as vice president, be the chairman of the caucus? There was some feeling that he should be, and he started out trying to do so, but it obviously just plain wouldn't work. Once you are vice president, you are removed from the normal operational routine of the majority or the minority in the Senate. You are a step above or beyond or outside of the Senate itself, even though you are its presiding officer. You are not one of the boys. You are, in a sense, a judge, a supervisor. You are not one of the action team. It was difficult for Lyndon Johnson to give up his role as majority leader. And it was equally difficult for Mike Mansfield, who was the incoming majority leader, to have Johnson serve as the chairman of the caucus. It was bound not to work. And I was one of those that thought it wouldn't work, and subsequently shared that point of view with both Lyndon Johnson and Bobby Baker. I think Bobby thought at the time that this would be a way for Lyndon to extend his control, continue his control in the Senate. But it was, if there's ever was a lesson in point, it was this particular example of where Vice President Johnson tried to maintain control in the United States Senate as if he were an ex officio majority leader. It just didn't add up, it didn't work, and I think that for once and for all it will set aside any such dreams or illusions for any future vice president. If it could have worked, Johnson would have made it so, because he had an overwhelming personality insofar as the Senate was concerned. He knew it. He knew where the power points were and the power positions. But once you're vice president, you are just a little different. You are no longer a member of the club. You may be the chairman of the club, but you're not a member. Well, when I was offered this opportunity of being whip, I was honored, of course. And my nomination and the arrangements were made for me to be nominated at the Democratic Caucus. And I don't recall exactly now how it was done, but I know that there were both Southerners. I know that the Southerners supported me, as did the Northerners. In other words, Johnson and Kennedy had made the arrangements, primarily Johnson. And I was elected unanimously by the caucus as majority whip. I would like to believe that I had some friends in that caucus, despite the plans that had been made for my nomination by the then Vice President Lyndon Johnson. But I think it is fair to say that had he resisted it, and had men like Dick Russell said no, that it would have been very difficult, if not impossible, to have been elected. The same would have been true for Mike Mansfield, but somewhat less the case, because he had been majority whip, and there was a natural succession to majority leader. But the new team was there, was Johnson as majority whip. When the new team was Mansfield majority leader, Humphrey majority whip, and George Smathers as the secretary to the majority. This was the team in the Senate in 1961 that was to be President Kennedy's top legislative leaders in the Senate. In the Senate period. We met regularly with President Kennedy, having breakfast every Wednesday morning. President Kennedy had what he called his legislative meeting at 8 o'clock at the White House in the dining room. We breakfasted together and discussed the legislative program for the week. The persons present at that breakfast were the President and the Vice President, the Majority Leader of the Senate and the House, the Majority Whip of the Senate and the House, the Speaker, and the Secretary of the Majority in the Senate, and and certain key members of the Kennedy administration, such as Larry O'Brien, Kenny O'Donnell, Claude Dessertel, and others that might be that President Kennedy used to promote his legislative program. Following these legislative breakfasts, the legislative breakfast, the majority leader of the House and the Senate would meet with the press and speak to the radio and television. Quite frankly, those meetings were never exploited to their best potential. I think it was a shame that they were not done, that more wasn't done. Speaker McCormick, while a fine man, was not always the spokesman, that was not always the best spokesman for the party on the radio or the television. Mansfield was not too communicative. His statements were terse, to the point, to be sure, but brief and seldom, I think, being to the point, period. What I'm saying is that I doubt that we used that free television time for all the good that we could have gotten out of it. I never, during all of those weeks and months that I served as majority whip, at no time did I appear on radio or television following those legislative breakfasts. And one of the reasons that I didn't was because I had heard that Speaker Rayburn had once said that while he liked Hubert Humphrey for majority whip, He was afraid that if he got that position, that he'd be monopolizing the radio and television time, or something to that effect. I made it my business never to seek the microphone or to push myself to the forefront. I do feel, however, that I was that I had a significant role to play in those legislative breakfasts and in the legislative leadership of the Senate. Both President Kennedy and Vice President Johnson often would talk to me about certain things that they wanted done over in the Senate, and I would try to get them done. And many times at the legislative breakfast, if a topic needed to be brought up that the president or the vice president didn't wish to open for discussion, I would be tipped off in advance and asked to bring it up on my own, which I would do. I was loyal to President Kennedy in my role as Majority Whip, but I was also exceedingly loyal to Mike Mansfield, the Majority Leader. I believe that Mike and myself made a good team. We balanced each other off. Mike never liked to visit with lobbyists or interest groups that would come to seek an audience with the Senate leadership. I didn't particularly care for it, but it didn't bother me, and so I took on that duty. I also worked very closely with a number of the more liberal senators, of the more liberal Democratic senators. I tried to do things for them that they needed done. I ran an office, my whip office, and gave the whip office a great deal of my time, concentrating my attention on the duties of that office so as to move the legislative program and to accommodate the needs and the wishes of many of our Senate colleagues. And while my office title was Majority Whip, I had very good close working relationships with many of the minority. My counterpart on the minority side was Senator Thomas Kuchel of California, K-U-C-H-E-L. We worked together very well. We were personal friends, and I held Tom in great respect and admiration. Therefore, we were able to discuss many of the legislative problems from a bipartisan point of view and out of personal friendship and mutual respect. I believe that the two of us did a good job. As the whip, it was my job to help line up votes for the president's legislative program. It was often my job and privilege to talk to members of the committees or the subcommittee chairman to promote or to urge action on legislation. But again, as whip, I worked under the general direction and guidelines of the majority leader and worked closely with him. And never at cross purposes. There is a great deal of difference, however, once you take on the role of leadership from that of being just a senator. When you are majority leader or majority whip, you have a responsibility to the majority as well as to your own constituency and your own political needs. As a matter of fact, being majority whip, you frequently have to accommodate your views to what might be the views of the administration, even though those views may not always be identical with yours. It surely isn't mandatory, but it is somewhat established by custom. In other words, if you are the majority leader for the majority party with a president of the majority party in power, the objective is to get the president's legislative program accomplished and passed, and that requires steadfastness and perseverance and loyalty on the part of the leadership of the Congress, and surely the majority leader and the majority whip. You still have your duties as senator, though. You have to vote. You vote in the Senate. You have your duties on your committees. You have your duties and responsibilities for your own constituency. So the role of Majority Whip is just an additional responsibility and an additional duty. One of the requirements is to pay very close attention to what happens on the floor of the Senate or in the deliberations of the Senate. I spent many hours in the Senate that I would not have spent if I had only been just the senator from Minnesota. The majority whip required that you be present at all times, that you know what was going on, if not present at all times. In other words, that if you were not there on the floor yourself, that you had a hand-picked deputy that would be there, and that you were within easy distance of the Senate floor so that you could come at a moment's notice. You had responsibility at times for moving legislative programs through the Senate once that they were called up for debate. It's what we term calling the calendar or calling up items from the Senate calendar, which is but a listing of the bills that have processed the committees and are ready for the action of the Senate as a whole. Once those bills are called up by the majority leader, then the majority whip has his share of the responsibility to see that the legislation is passed, or if amendments are offered, hopefully to see that those amendments are defeated if they run contrary to the program of the Senate and the administration, to see that those amendments are adopted if those amendments are needed for the program of the majority or the president. I cannot overemphasize the amount of detail, the detailed work that is required. Many hours were I spent in the Senate while senators spoke on in long speeches. Somebody had to be there to make sure that this work of the Senate proceeded, that quorums were called, that notices were given, and that the program for the next day or the balance of the week was outlined. Frequently, this was done by the majority leader, but if he was absent, then the majority whip would have to do so. And on occasion, the majority leader would share this responsibility with the majority whip. As majority whip, I generally was present for what we call the calling of the calendar of those bills that were not to be subject to prolonged debate. This meant, again, attention to detail, being there on the job, and seeing to it that bills that were objected to by senators were put aside, seeing to it that senators that wanted to be heard when a particular bill was called up, that those senators were called and informed that the legislation in which they was interested was now up for debate. In other words, you were the Senate's servant. You were selected by your colleagues, not only for leadership, but for service to them, to the president, and to the country. It was in this role as majority whip that much of the legislation in which I had a personal interest was adopted. The Peace Corps, for example, the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. These two important pieces of legislation, which I sponsored and which I had designed, were recommended by the president. Hearings were held in the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, of which I was a member. I attended all of those hearings, frequently conducted the questioning, or even conducted some of the hearings themselves. And when those bills came to the floor of the Senate, I handled the legislation. In other words, I was the floor leader for the measures. Now this would have been my duty as a senator alone, but it became an extra responsibility when I was majority whip, because it was legislation in which I had a keen personal interest, legislation of which I was the author and which I had helped develop and process, and it was imperative. It was also administration program. So as a part of the administration's program, it was my duty as majority whip to see that it was passed and hopefully intact without weakening amendments, and to see that it became law. As majority whip of the Senate, I was also the floor leader for the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Again, I could have been the floor leader for that bill without being majority whip. But since it was once again administration legislation, as well as matters of legislative policy in which I had a keen personal interest, my duties as Majority Whip added an extra dimension to the responsibilities that were mine while that legislation was before us. I consider the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 the most singularly important achievement of my legislative career. It tested me as nothing else had ever done in terms of my legislative ability and my generalship of managing a bill. It also tested my sense of discipline, self-discipline, and my capacity of leadership over others. I believe that in all of these matters, I came out well. We were able to not only break the filibuster, but to pass a strong, comprehensive program of civil rights legislation, and to do it without crippling amendments. I was also able to organize the speakers for the respective titles of the bill, to keep our members, to keep those who were in favor of the bill well informed as to developments day in and day out, to maintain a sense of discipline and orderliness in the debate, not to let it get out of hand, to preserve a spirit of goodwill, even though the subject was highly emotional and explosive. And I can say that we came out of that debate on civil rights without personal bitterness or anger. In fact, I was complimented by Southern leaders for having so managed the debate and directed the progress of the bill so as not to arouse anger and bitterness amongst the members of the Senate. As Majority Whip, I tried to keep a very careful